This is a podcast from WILL AM 580. To support our station, please visit www.willpledge.org. That's www.willpledge.org.
This is the AM 580 News Daily Podcast. For Monday, August 20th, I'm Jeff Bossert. Coming up, Amy Guida has this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News, and we'll have a look at your AM 580 weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. But first, today's news. Illinois' state budget stalemate could have a long-term effect on a regional agency that provides seniors with meals, medication, and other needs. The East Central Illinois Agency on Aging is dependent on grant funds through Illinois' Department on Aging. Executive Director Michael O'Connell says the state has already cut short the state's community care program, which operates through Medicaid, by $25 million by combining a number of services. O'Connell says while state and federal funds will cover other grant-related assistance, anything extra would need the approval of lawmakers.
Those receiving home-delivered meals will continue to receive home-delivered meals. Those who rely upon transportation services specifically for older adults will continue to be served. The problem as we see it comes a little bit later down the road because under our Constitution in Illinois, all federal and state funds must be appropriated by the General Assembly and approved by the governor.
A line item for $100,000 in the budget plan vetoed by Governor Rod Blagojevich would supplement funding for the agency. The funds would provide temporary help with things like medication, utility bills, and rental assistance, and help seniors raising grandchildren. The funds were sought by Senator Dan Rutherford of Pontiac. But O'Connell says he doesn't want to give the impression that these services would end, but he says any delay in funds may require some facilities to take out a bank loan in the meantime. The East Central Illinois Agency on Aging serves senior care facilities in 16 counties, including Champaign and Vermilion. A pastor says an illegal immigrant who took refuge in a Chicago church and has been deported to Mexico will keep organizing for immigrant rights. The Reverend Walter Coleman says Elvira Arellano is free in Tijuana and will keep talking to organizations throughout Mexico and congressmen in Mexico City. Coleman spoke with Arellano on the phone. He says the plan is to continue organizing for immigration rights and attend a rally in Washington on September 12th. Immigration authorities arrested Arellano yesterday in Los Angeles. She had sought refuge in the Adalberto United Methodist Church to avoid being separated from her 8-year-old son. She left the church for the first time in a year to campaign for immigration reform in Los Angeles this weekend. Governor Rod Blagojevich's running mate continues his push to give voters the ability to recall elected officials in Illinois. Amanda Vinicky has more.
Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn says this year's legislative session was poisoned.
There's been a lot of name-calling and bickering. I don't think that's healthy.
Quinn says there would be less of that if Illinois voters could vote politicians out of office during their terms.
That would maybe get some of the incumbents in office at all levels to be more focused on the people rather than on their own political matters.
Quinn says he doesn't know how Governor Blagojevich would fare if Illinois already had recalls. He says having the procedure on the books would make everyone be a better office holder in the first place. Several lawmakers have introduced legislation aimed at pushing Blagojevich out of office. Blagojevich says allowing recalls is a good idea. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
People in the United States are living in a world of pain, and they're taking medication at an alarming rate to deal with it. An Associated Press analysis says the amount of 5 major painkillers sold at retail establishments rose 90% between 1997 and 2005. Overall, Illinois had one of the lowest percentage increases in painkiller use. It climbed about 45% from 1997 to 2005, which is roughly half the national average. However, the state's change in oxycodone use was much higher, 828% versus 591% for the national average. Also, contrary to the national trend, meparidin use climbed in pockets of southern and central Illinois. Codeine use skyrocketed in Chicago's northwest suburbs. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield has new information on a 1909 Illinois coal mine disaster. A Princeton man has donated new source material on the incident in Bureau County when workers tried to rescue men who were trapped in an underground coal mine. The information comes from years of research. It includes newspaper articles, diaries, legal documents, and more than 500 photographs. The museum's executive director says Illinois has a rich mining history full of stories about ordinary men and women doing extraordinary things. He says the collection enhances what is available to researchers. The museum opened 2 years ago. The adjoining library houses the world's largest collection of Lincoln documents and artifacts. For the latest newscast online, go to wiol.uiuc.edu/news. This is the AM 580 News Daily Podcast. I'm Jeff Bosser. Mine safety has been a major news story over the past few weeks, with renewed calls for additional legislation to protect miners. But as commentator Amy Guider reports in this week's Legal Issues in the News, that's a call that's been heard and heeded for many years.
About 40 years ago, 78 people died in an explosion at a West Virginia coal mine. Within a year, Congress passed the Federal Coal Mine Safety Act, promising more effective means and measures for improving the working conditions within mines. The 1968 tragedy that prompted the legislation was then only the latest reminder that coal mining has long been one of the most dangerous occupations in the world. Yet the 1969 legislation that followed now serves as a reminder itself of the limits of the law in ensuring the safety of miners. The extreme dangers of mining have been the stuff of ballads and anthems for more than 100 years. And for almost as long, courts and lawmakers have debated how to make things better. The 1969 legislation was full of promise. It called miners the most precious resource of the mining industry and vowed to address unsafe and unhealthful conditions and practices. It set, for the first time, federal safety standards in the mines and outlined enforcement procedures and penalties for violations. These were, in fact, significant steps, and they were followed 8 years later by even more ambitious federal legislation, the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977, and the creation of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. But as miners themselves know best of all, legislative declarations go only so far to prevent accidents. In fact, law itself has sometimes been the obstacle, as Congress recognized when it acted 40 years ago to get rid of technical or common law distinctions that left miners exposed to danger. Even when miners won legal victories, early courts often took them away. Take, for example, a case from Colorado in 1895. There, the state Supreme Court reversed a $5,000 jury verdict for a miner's widow. The court found that the jury instructions had improperly favored the plaintiff by implying that mining companies had a duty to guarantee a safe working environment. That, the court wrote, is not the law. And it still isn't, even today. Mines are far safer, thanks in part to stricter safety laws. 100 years ago, more than 3,200 coal miners lost their lives in the mines. Last year, 47 coal miners were killed in this country. That's a far cry from last century's losses, but still more than twice the number from the previous year. Union representatives, safety advocates, and some former government officials again blame the law. They claim that federal and state enforcement of mine safety rules had softened in recent years. Although Congress again acted in 2006 to strengthen federal safety standards in response to a string of mine disasters last year, The Wall Street Journal suggested last week that the mine collapse in Utah had exposed the shortcomings of that legislation. Even more recently, Forbes.com reported that lawmakers were calling for tougher mine safety laws, even as rescuers worked on the Utah mine collapse last week. And then came last week's news that two rescuers and an inspector with the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration had died in a cave-in while trying to reach the original victims of the Utah mine collapse. Their deaths, occurring under the most intense public scrutiny imaginable, virtually under the glare of the assembled media and with federal safety inspectors immediately at hand, is a tragic affirmation of something miners and their families have always known. The law can make mines safer, but it can never make them safe. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. In the forecast for the region today, mostly cloudy and humid, a few showers and thunderstorms possible, the high 83. Cloudy and humid tonight, some showers and thunderstorms possible, the low around 70. Tomorrow, intervals of clouds and hazy sunshine, very warm and humid. A few passing showers and thunderstorms, the high 88. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night. Humid, a chance of a passing shower or thunderstorm, the low 71. Mostly sunny, hot, and humid on Wednesday, the high 93. This has been the AM 580 News Daily Podcast for Monday, August 20th. You can find podcasts of Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, agricultural programming, as well as other helpful information at our website, will.uiuc.edu. I'm Jeff Bossert, AM 580 News.